Melanie Brannigan Fredrickson lives and writes in Winnipeg on Treaty One territory. She is the author of the chapbook Poseidon's Cove, Athena's Cave with Model Press in 2021. Her poems have been published in Plus Doc, a journal of longer poems, the Winnipeg Free Press, Contemporary Verse 2, arcpoetry.ca, and Prairie Fire. She writes a monthly column reviewing poetry for the Winnipeg Free Press. Welcome, Melanie.
Hello. Really nice to see so many friendly faces and familiar names. I'm going to read to you today from sort of two separate projects. The first I'm going to read to you is from our sections from the chapbook Poseidon's Cove, Athena's Cave. And it's sort of the instantiating event of a longer manuscript. And I think what you need to know is that there are multiple speakers in many of these poems, and they're often speaking at the same time, so which kind of a challenge for one person. So I'll sort of let you know who's talking and try to break things up in a way that conveys some sense. So among other things at stake in this long poem and in the subsequent movements of the manuscript is a transformation that takes place. And so the poem begins with an epigraph by Anne Carson. And she writes in Men in the Off Hours that the women of mythology regularly lose their form in monstrosity. And the chorus begins, symptoms show small signs of smoothing. On the 25th day, the doctors send Amy home, a one-day trial just to see. And here's Amy, who says, I don't want. Even at home, the non-color of hospital walls suffuses even the leaves and dappled sunshine, even the glints off the pool. I don't want. Mom's glares, sharp, shaming, chase me to the field, the old schoolhouse, the pool, to watch while Emma swims her countless laps. Why don't I plunge like Emma? The tips of my fingers trail in the deep end. Sun warms my shoulders and limbs. The rhythm of my sister's strokes. Peace for the first time in months. And in this next section, there are sort of six speakers. And the chorus again begins. This need to tell fights years, lines rigidly stratified. And Amy says, not for the first time. And then her mother says, my daughter left. My daughter falsely accused her father. And then Amy's father says, my daughter false. My daughter broke her mother's heart. And then Emma says, my sister left, my sister lied. And as these speakers are sort of speaking over her, Amy says, not for the first time they've told the story to mute. I was. And then the community breaks in and says, the weight of testimony, mother plus father plus sister are greater than Amy the false, Amy the mad. And Amy ends, and nothing I could do to stop it. And here she continues, "When the wall breaks, will I be swept to sea or melted to lava? Will I be turned to coral or basalt?" And here is the chorus. "The scene contains three people and one pool. Then water splashes wrong. Then wind blows ill." And then Amy's father says, "You made our lives hell for a whole goddamn year because you don't know?" And then the chorus says, "Then mother, father, sunshine, pool, persona, time, collapse." And then Amy says, "Statue still, not for the first time. I should plunge." Sorry, fumbling. And then Amy continues, "Not for the first time. The sun recedes, a pin point." And the chorus says, "The scene contains three people, mother, Amy, father." And Amy says, "Not for the first time. Concrete cold, bare back, shadow over dad's left shoulder." And the chorus says, "The scene contains mother, redacted, Amy, frozen, father, redacted." And Amy says, "Cold concrete, wrists pinned, prick of sun." And this next section is sort of written as a palimpsest, and under the sort of text of my poem are various translations of Ovid's account of Medusa's transformation. I'm just going to share my screen to show that to you so that I don't try to read Ovid. Okay. Is that working? Thumbs up, thumbs down? Okay. And in this section, there are four speakers, and the chorus is sort of, again, directing your gaze. And it starts, "The scene contains mother," who says, "You'll learn to stop telling lies if it's the last thing." And then the chorus breaks in, "Amy," who says, "Another spell, another name caught in my throat." And then the chorus says, "Father, I'll show you, redacted." And Amy says, "His words punch air from my lungs." And then the chorus says, "Three people and one gun." In the next section, the chorus says, "Pretend you don't know what happened then." And Amy says, "Not for the first time." And then the chorus, "Pretend you know what happens next." And in this last section, Amy sort of has the last word, and she says, "Spent, not for the first time. Left in the dark, not for the first time. I pull myself up the stairs, gather chaos of limbs and snot, stifle the rasp, sob, my sister's name before it leaves my throat. Spent, for the first time I breathe, never return. For the first time I turn my blood basalt." Okay, and I'm going to give us all a break from me trying to do multiple people's things. And the second sort of the second manuscript I'm going to read to you from is an attempt to respond to and rise to Phyllis Webb's call in her poem to friends who have also considered suicide. In that poem, Webb writes, "We, my friends, who have considered suicide, take our daily walk with death and are not lonely." And here's the title poem from that manuscript, and it's called Have Considered. The first lesson. Know the currents of the river like you know your veins, without entering the river. You wrestle Hydra every night. Each head spits your mother's scorn, each imprecation cleverer than you. Attention seeking is what the police call the unnamed woman, behavior on bridges. Does anyone see your white knuckles grip the railing on the footbridge behind the BDI? Your imagination freezes, unable to see a step onto solid ground. Your traumas flow and catch along the banks, debris for the geese to hide their eggs. The second lesson, remember the first. And so this manuscript is both sort of about a fairly severe bout of mental illness, and it's also responding to various poems and pieces of art and sort of strains of thought. And the next poem I'm going to read is, in essence, based on a misreading of Rilke. And it's a little bit of an argument with Rilke, or it started that way, and it's now a little different. And at the beginning of the first of the Duino elegies, Rilke writes, "Because beauty's nothing but the start of terror we can hardly bear." And the poem is called Mental Miss. When your psychiatrist ends a sentence with "not discount the possibility of hospitalization," you stumble through the threshold to 25 years ago, to 8 stories above Olette Avenue, where the ward locks, the rooms don't. Now, swallow your first words. I'd rather drink bleach. Now, imagine saying, "A teacher brought me Rilke's elegies there. I read a state of terror into its start." Imagine you could say, "I was 15. It was a locked ward." Remember 15, remember locks. Remember nipples puckering from the cold, unhidden by the hospital gown. Remember 15, curling away from doctors, nurses, parents, curling away even from the walls, just enough off-white to swallow the possibility of color. Imagine that could be understood. Now, whisper, "Terror has a start?" Now say no. Imagine that could be understood. Whisper, "Terror, a state of unending beige." The next poem I'm going to read is a poem I wrote a long time ago. And it's a response to an homage of Derek Yarman's film Blue, which is not a biographical film that is about his going blind and dying of AIDS, or the knowledge that he's dying. And this poem is called The Blues. Why every story ends in violets. Voices of dead friends, absent family, reach through blue, transcend our bodies' solemn geographies. Judy comes twice a day, brings a drip for the dead and dying. A chasm opens and she says, "My blood will kill anything." Reality drowns in theater. Been blind so long, I still shut my eyes against train wreck, bright lights, early morning. This drip drips the song of my room. Each word, sunbeam gleam, sight out of time. I don't see her sobbing. My lover leaves and her howled betrayal drives me to madness. Architectonics of scream on sound. Closeted and frightened. Sexuality, sourpuss, suicide. Blues fight disease, yellow-bellied. Morphine drips dispel the pain. Now agony is tangible. Remember. Frantic drip passes frantic seconds. Her last kiss flares. Match struck at night. Kiss me, again, kiss me. Flares and dies. Again and again and again. We repeat ritual goodbyes. See you tomorrow. Fade to black. Sweet Judy Blue left. Smiled at Jean Cocteau, who smiled back. Suede shoes ought to be enough to walk me out of life. Salt lips touch blue tears. One afternoon she cried because I could not. Now I cannot stop. One of the things I'm working out in the broader manuscript have considered is how to talk about trauma and mental illness while sort of resisting the voyeurism and judgment that accompany writing about those things, especially in my experience writing women's writing about those things. And so the last two poems I'm going to read are sort of experiments toward that resistance. And the first is called Ariadne Left, Anatomy of a Flashback. You trace stories. Imagine your brain, a labyrinth, well, worn and looping, the monster howling down. In the hippocampal sulcus, arrive to the frayed edge loose thread you thought led home. Lost sleep, lost in. You convulse. The parahippocampal gyrus heaves too many scents. Bounce dryer sheets, mildewy basement, peanut butter, bathrobe, body, breath. Lost sleep, lost in. Sleep lost in hours in the car. Hours lost to the monster's howl. Then, imagine you're a labyrinth. Days later, looping, you lost, not 14 after all. A story not howled down a path to rubble. And the last poem I'm going to read sorry, is called And the Uncertain Edge. And sort of in this poem are sort of direct quotations from John Trimmer's translation of Schrödinger's cat paradox paper and Robert Fagel's translation of the Odyssey, and also Virginia Woolf's suicide note. And the Uncertain Edge. Perhaps she will understand why Irwin posits the cat, alive and dead, the atoms that make up the cat, the live one, the dead one, mixed or smeared out in equal parts. In a sealed chamber, a woman is penned. She has a face because everyone has a face. But what is it doing there in a steel bed rail? Is she sentence snarled infinitely between what good can come of grief and now down we came to the ship at the water's edge? The cat, framed by the window when the sun sets, meows twice, disappears into shadow thoughts. She thought she left Sylvia behind, a brief wisp of a memory from sometime in her 20s. Sunday morning, she retreats from herself. 15 minutes become an afternoon and a day spent aching for the Pacific, heart pressed to the grass under the dying elm. Unable to forget Virginia's gasp, I can't read. The lines that open and close whole worlds. The ones that matter, unfinished. A silent disturbance in the night brings the cat. Needle sharp claws kneading. You.
Ooh, that was beautiful. Thank you so much. I knew it would be, but I'm still blown away. Oh, wow. All right. I'm going to stop the recording.